Welcome to Leadership Amplified, where my goal is to inspire leaders to get more impact with their teams, to promote inclusive leadership, and to make leadership more satisfying. In today's episode, I'm speaking with Kate Christensen, who's a thought leader in change and complexity. I'm looking forward to talking with Kate about how leaders can create more focus and be more influential through the way they engage with complexity. And in particular, how they use questions. Kate Christensen is an adaptability specialist who helps top-tier leaders make disruption easier and build what she calls unstoppable teams. She's the creator of the Curly Approach, which is trademarked, and it uses question-based frameworks to create clarity out of complexity. Kate is the author of two books: The Thrive Cycle, How to Build a Customer-Driven, Unstoppable Organization by Activating Its Adaptive DNA. And the other is Curly Conversations for Teams. The Thrive Cycle book won an Axiom International Book Award. Kate, welcome to the podcast. It's a great pleasure to have you here. And I know we're going to have a wonderful conversation about you, your leadership journey, but also we're going to get in stuck into this idea of questions and thinking and curliness. So welcome.
Thank you. Thanks, Karen.
Yeah, great. Okay, without further ado, let's kick off and hear a bit about your leadership journey. You've had senior leadership roles, you work independently now, but tell us about your story.
Oh, I don't know about you, but I whenever anyone asks me to talk about my story, I'm not always a bit dubious now as to how far I go back.
So not the very beginning, shall I
Well, I
say
began.
that? Not the very beginning.
Excuse me. I think, yeah, I think one of the things around that question, and as you know, I love a good question, is that it's as I look back now over, pretty much 3 decades of my working life, is what I've realized is that I've pretty much spent 30 years navigating complexity and disruption for a living. And it started really quite early in my career. So one of my first jobs was I joined a startup. It was in the days when mobile phones were the size of bricks. And this startup had started in Australia, but didn't really have a lot of the operational elements behind it. So they opened their call center, and at that time I joined as the training manager, but I joined to a company that had no materials around it, and I didn't even own a mobile phone. And so what I needed to do was work out, well, we're opening in 2 weeks, and we're going to have all these people on the phones that don't know how to answer a question on a mobile phone. And so I went through and I got all the phones that we had, and I went through and worked out the top 10 questions that were around that people might ask, and I worked out how to do that, and I put it in a folder and things like that. And so then over my career, I very rarely went into roles that had been done by somebody before. They're often new role, and often they were created because something had changed and there was a mission critical thing that needed to happen. And if it didn't happen, there were going to be some significant consequences. And those were either bad consequences or lost opportunity. So I kind of did that. I did it in Australia, and then I kind of moved over into to do that on a global level. So going into I led a global program around something that was a very foundational business element, which is about solvency. Like, has your business got enough money or not? And if it hasn't, then you're insolvent. So I did that for a couple of years, and I think it was in the area of finance and actuarial, and it was really very detailed, very technical. And finance was not something I'd managed to avoid finance roles pretty much most of my life. And part of the reason I went into that role was because I'd been avoiding it. I thought, blow it, I'm going to do it. So, and then from there, I moved into, worked in Asia, looking in emerging markets to find new markets, to find new opportunities. And again, starting there with pretty much nothing, knowing nothing about working in Asia. And so I kind of, as I was reflecting on that question, I kind of think, well, what was my expertise over my corporate life?
Yes, my
And
question exactly. What
what
is
was
it that
so
you then brought?
yeah, so I as I say it out loud, I possibly will want to take it back, but I kind of became an expert in knowing nothing, but still getting the job done.
I think there's another way to say that. Expert
How would
in
you say
nothing.
it?
Well, I
In
think.
knowing nothing and getting the job done, so
Done.
starting
Yeah.
with nothing.
Yeah. So I would say from that that either you're a great generalist, so you've got a set of generalist skills and ways of thinking about particular kind of problem circumstances, issues, or the great in uncertainty and disruption. It doesn't throw you. You see it as a positive thing, so you can step into that. So there's kind of mindset, skills, ways of thinking about that that all sound, I think, quite precious. Not just back, earlier times in your career, but they're very precious right now. And probably I would say under-recognized, undervalued, even by yourself in a way. Just underused in organizations. So thinking more about how you would say that differently, I'm not trying to turn this into a coaching session,
Oh, no,
but
I'm all for coaching.
expert in nothing, what's a different way of putting that, Kate?
Well, and I love that question. And I love the way that this interaction is going. It actually leads into what we're also going to talk about is about it would have been about 4 or 5 years ago when I'd moved out of corporate life and I had my own practice and I wanted to understand, I wanted to not just be good at what I was good at, and I wanted to understand what was it that I was good at and why did it work, and was there something that I could teach other people about it? And I think to your point, you've really captured a key motivation behind that is that there were times in my leadership when there were things that appeared to be very obvious to me around the way that things were working because of the way my brain worked and because of my attraction to complexity, attraction to not knowing, and that excitement that can come with it. And I never really understood during my corporate career why that was. Why, what was I doing differently? Why couldn't they see it? And the stuff that I do now is around curly thinking. Curly thinking is what I was describing before. It's a fundamentally different way of structuring your thinking and with approaching a situation that is not straightforward. So, assumptions, mindsets, all of the things that you talked about. And where that comes down to, well, how does that link in with questions? And I guess a real passion that I have for questions is that questions are like the keys to your brain. We don't have a keyboard. You can't reprogram your brain using a keyboard and say, okay, I'd like to change the way I'm thinking now. Hang on, I'll just press, function F and there we go. Questions are the things that enable us to tap into the pathways and what we know. And from my perspective in the work that I do, help for us to explore discover and do it confidently in the unknown as much as we do in the known. And that's kind of how that came together. So, good question.
But brilliant answer. I mean that questions, we'll get back to your story, but questions can phase people, but they don't phase people so much. So I like, that idea of having a key, because we're always thinking, how do we deal with complexity? And if we don't know the answer and we have all the information, we don't even know what all the information is that we need, then how can you possibly think differently? So I love that idea of questions being keys to unlock, or to, it's almost like one of those clever little mazes or computer games where this little door reveals and that little door closes and things just kind of unlock. That's a wonderful metaphor that you're using. And different parts of the brain are revealed. And I think the other thing that she does as I sort of respond to that is that what it says, the answer is within you, or you have answers within you, that, that fear of not knowing what to do or not knowing what the answer to the question might be, not knowing how you deal with the disruption, can kind of be managed with, through the through using the key in that neat sort of way.
And the I find the concept of a key useful because of that, and the recognition that if you want to go through the door, you need to get the key first. And one of the challenges that I experience and that my clients experience often is when they get to that moment of being stuck, cognitively stuck. I'm thinking, oh, it's like your brain's hit a wall. Now what do I do? How do I deal with this situation? Often we're asking ourselves a question that is not useful. It's the wrong key. It will not open the door. And when you understand that, okay, before I try and push my way through the door so I can get to that really, that answer that I really, really, really want, hang on, what kind of key do I need? What is the question that I need to answer in order for me to be able to move from where I am now forward? That's the only thing in that situation that you need. And yet, what we do is we go, we don't even think what question we're answering. What we do is we leap to an answer or try to leap to an answer that is just too far away. And that's where questions are so powerful.
And there is such a drive to solution, is there not, in organizations? So I think that firstly, the idea that we would kind of start exploring things through questions, it's a bit like, well, that's going to take time. But then, as you're saying, I mean, you've got a neat system, you've got the locks, you've got the keys. And you know how to make the match, so that kind of people can open up. And I think also you'll say, just take one step forward. The idea that you don't have to solve everything, while that's a bit tricky for some people to kind of sit with too, I mean, that makes it easier, doesn't it? The task isn't to solve all the problems of the world,
That's
although we'd
right.
like to. It's just to take one step forward to get some momentum.
Yes, because you never, after you've taken that first step, you never actually know what position you'll be in. You might think it's a small step, but it may be the step that you needed where everything falls into place. And I often talk with people about and sorry, coming back to your point, which is 100% right, is that we often leap to solution, organizations often leap to solution. And that's because for lots and lots of reasons, it's a biological, neurological drive that we have. But it's also something that we're taught to do. We are taught about answers. And up until the age of 4, we ask lots and lots and lots of questions. And then we go to school. And then we learn that actually the questions are not the things that matter. It's actually getting the answers on the page that matters. And that need for efficiency, and our brains are wired for efficiency. That's why we're so clever. That's why we are not the apes. It's because we can process stuff quickly because we can make those neural pathways over time, and then we don't even need to think about them, and we don't need to take up brain space. So really, I think of it in terms of different mindsets. So really, often it's our brain being more like a four-wheel drive. A four-wheel drive, we don't expect it to be the fastest. We don't expect it to be the fastest car on the road, but we don't even expect it to be on the road, because a four-wheel drive is for off-roading, and it's to deal with rough terrain. So what if we said, actually, given the complexity of the situation we have, given we are not in Kansas anymore, we can't just go from A to B, what if we adopted this four-wheel drive kind of mentality? And how would we be thinking, and what would we be expecting within that kind of space?
Well, and the beauty of the four-wheel drive is that you can still drive it on a nice highway, freeway, and get where
Yes.
you need to go.
Yes.
Maybe not as fast as you might in your Ferrari, but however,
Yeah.
you will certainly get there.
Yeah.
But the idea, it is ready and it's got the equipment so that when you go off-road, you flick that switch, you use that key, ask that question, and then you take yourself, properly equipped into that new terrain.
And
Beautiful.
as a leader, and a lot of the curly thinking approach is about how you lead yourself. And I know that you do a lot of work in the leading yourself space, and that flexible thinking. How can you flex the way that you think? But it's equally important in the way that you lead people through disruption and through uncertainty, because the questions that you ask them and the way that you help them to adopt a four-wheel drive kind of model in their head, and sit with that, that's different, and that's a different way of doing things, actually determines who's still on the in the vehicle when you get to the destination. Because if you try and get all these people to drive off-road with the mindset of the go-kart, you know, it's a pretty rough old ride. And half your people never make it to the other side.
Exactly. But the idea of the team, everyone in their four-wheel drive, that means you can cover an awful lot of terrain, and it doesn't matter if some of it isn't terrain you want to keep or is necessary for the solution or the
That's right.
destination. But you've got all that sort of necessary redundancy built in. So I'm enjoying the conversation, the discussion about questions, but I do want to come back to Kate because we haven't done Kate kind of well enough. I mean, one of the things that I think I'd like to know about you is, I mean, you've said a lot of the roles that you stepped into didn't exist before,
Yes.
and you're kind of an expert in nothing. But what do you think it is that, you know, what are, how did you develop the ability to do this? Were there particular experiences, particular leaders you were exposed to, opportunities you were given, or does this go back to being four? How do you think this sort of approach and set of capabilities came about?
Another excellent question. I think the part of the way that it came about was the being, the phrase, feel the fear and do it anyway. So there were roles that I looked at where I thought, I really don't think I'm up for this. You know, that we all have those little voices telling us, I
We
really
do.
don't think I'm up for it. And I decided, no, I'm going to do it anyway. And I treated it as a challenge to just do it and prove things. When I was in, when I took the role, working in Indonesia, the Philippines, but mainly in Indonesia, I almost didn't take that role because of nothing to do with the role itself, but to do with the fact that it was in Indonesia and I was going to be working in a lot of areas where socioeconomically were not very high on the scale. And I didn't think personally that I'd be able to deal with that. And so I took the role because I wanted to show that I can do things like that. So it was a real, I guess, challenging fears was a lot of it. Yes, ambition was there, but I think coming back to I think point I've already made, which is I love a challenge. I love the uncertainty. And I think of it as cognitive bungee jumping. I love being in a
Well, that's
situation
just
where I,
scared of you listeners.
going into a situation and thinking, I don't know what to do. I don't know. It's like, what's the, Thank God You're Here. Have you ever watched that improv show where they walk through a door, a famous person walks through a door to a bunch of improvising actors, and suddenly it's like they are in a role and they need to do something. I
And
get a
they've
buzz
got
out
no
of it.
forewarning.
No forewarning.
You do. Look, I think that's absolutely amazing. And I think, Kate, you know that, I mean, one of the concerns that I have with leadership is that we have an expectation that we get certainty from leaders, that these leaders know what to do, that they've got the answers. And we really underplay doubt and what I would call sort of reasonable doubt, when we kind of hire people and when we kind of ask them to do things and what we expect from them. And you're certainly bucking that trend, which I think is, amazing and what we need to do a lot more of. And from what I can hear, it's absolutely helped your career. So you've, prepared to admit to yourself what you don't know, what scares the you know what out of you, and then step into that challenge anyway. So for people who are kind of listening and wondering whether that's something that they would want to do, how do you manage, what was the four-wheel drive that you took with you, into Indonesia, apart from the real one that you might have taken? What was it that allowed
If I
you
can
to
find the
kind of
road.
face the fear, and navigate successfully?
I think one of the things is around recognizing that not knowing it does not equal incompetent. Right?
Yeah,
Just
nice.
because you don't know the answer to a question doesn't make you a poor leader. It doesn't mean that you are incompetent. It just means that you don't know an answer. And I think that's really important. It was particularly important for me in the space that I was working at, but I think it's particularly important for leaders today because there is so much uncertainty. And I think rethinking, and this is partly coming back to the curly question stuff, is and reflecting on that, is rethinking what a question is and what its purpose is. Because I believe that there are many myths about questions, and they come from our history, and they come from a whole heap of things that we engender, I guess, in from a cultural perspective. But if you think that a question requires a right answer, then we don't step into it. And that's both when we ask a question and when someone asks us a question, right? But what if we see a question not just as something that gives us information, but what if we saw a question as something that could light someone up and get them excited about something that they either hadn't thought to think about or hadn't realized, hadn't asked enough questions to get to a point where they've gone, That's really cool.
Hmm.
And where you have those aha moments. When have you ever been in a room and someone asks a question and you go, "Oh, I've never thought about it like that before."
Yes.
Right? And when you think of questions as being a tool that can light people up, that can change direction, that can enable you to do pretty much anything, then uncertainty is no longer scary. It's you can be curious about it, but and confident, I guess.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Okay, Kate. So let's just go back to talking about you. So big corporate career in different countries around the world, as well as Australia, and then you moved into your own practice. So, and tell us about, what you were seeking to do in setting up your practice.
Great question. So what I really, when I left corporate life, I didn't have a plan, is the
Oh, good.
reality. I
That
didn't have a
sounds like a
plan.
pattern.
So no plan. Let's just give it a go. And I ended up I was in say a government
Government.
agency. Who is a customer? And when you've got the government over here and you've got stakeholders over there. And we went through this process, and essentially, after getting the leaders on board, clarifying what these key elements were, I then worked with the leaders to make sure that we asked the right questions. And then they asked the questions of their team. We did an event for 60 people where they went through, came up with their strategy and their plan, and particularly what was it it was needing to answer. And I spoke to the client a little bit later on, and I said, "How are you going?" This is a couple of weeks later. And she said, "Look, those conversations that we had up front have kind of made the change a bit of a non-event." Because the challenge with change, or one of the challenges with change, is not change itself. It's that people don't know why it's happening, or it's incongruent. I see the change happening over here, but I'm not sure where it's coming from, what it's for, or why it even matters. And I don't really care. So what the vital thread did was say, okay, put people in the center, customers and people in the center, and recognize that for your strategy, the process will then take care of itself. So that's one. There's lots of examples in it, but it's very energizing.
Yes, and I can feel it. It sounds really exciting. It feels really exciting having the conversation and just kind of hearing and seeing your enthusiasm about that. And I think that when a customer kind of comes to you and say, "We were set up right, then we did it, and we got the outcome we want." I mean, what more do you
What
need?
more could you want? Yeah,
That's brilliant.
grinning
That's
from ear
brilliant.
to ear. Yeah, that's very special.
That idea of making things easy in a world that seems too complex and difficult. So, we have at various points in this conversation, Kate, danced around the issue of curly questions and big questions and disruption and all those important things.
Yes.
Tell us really about what your curly question approach is and what it's designed to do.
Yeah. So what it's the Curly approach is a structured framework. And so it's a way of visualizing and structuring complexity or complex situations and breaking it into parts that are manageable. So that's it at its highest level. And then, so that's step one. And the step two is, which is how it feeds more collaborative problem solving or complex problem solving, is that when you can break the challenge into parts and you can physically see it, like the power of mental models and physical models, is that what happens is people start trying to address the challenge or work through the challenge in a particular structured way instead of trying to sort it out on their own. What it also does is it gives people a language and a way of working out where they are relative to other people. So, with regard to a particular challenge or question, so that you can then talk about it and instead of going, taking position around, I think this is the answer, and then person B says, I think this is the answer, you go, okay, let's ignore that for a moment. Where are we on the problem? What do you think the problem is? But so it's very much that element. And then the next thing is around being clear around what the questions that are answerable now and being clear that actually we're in a curly situation. Okay, we're in a curly situation. Right, guys, we need to think differently and give ourselves permission to think differently, and speak differently and have different assumptions and expectations about what's going to come out of this conversation. And that's sort of the base of the framework.
I think that sounds nice. I think that idea of, if the conversation and the collaboration is about me, it's about my ability to think of the right answers, then potentially I have the fight or flight response, and that, diminishes my cognitive resources rather than increases them. Where it was, you're saying, here's a collaborative arena that we're getting together on, and by using that different language for positioning it, as well as opening up the permission around questions, and great questions, obviously, it just means I can engage in a completely different way. It's not about me being in the spotlight, it's about
It's about
contributing.
that, this thing
That's right,
over
this
there.
thing. I love that. So that's a huge reframe.
Yes, and the additional reframe is that using this framework is based on what is your critical curly question? Like, what is the critical curly question? And getting agreement around that, and turning what. And I was thinking about this from an examples perspective. So, as a leader, you might have a whole list of things that are issues or challenges. And like one of my clients had a challenge around, we're just trying to implement too many initiatives at once,
Yes.
right?
Hello.
Right. Hello, prioritization strikes again. But when we phrase it as trying to implement too many initiatives at once, it sucks our energy. You just kind of
Correct.
your shoulders drop and you just go, oh. But if you can then turn that into a question, which is, and this is what we did with my client in this Clarity Lab, was how could we coordinate and align initiatives and reduce the number of parallel projects? Right? Same challenge, but because we'd made it into a question and we'd agreed on what the question was, then you can start to get clarity and alignment. The challenge with, strategies or problem solving or all sorts of things is that we try to get alignment behind the solution. What we really needed was alignment behind the question.
Behind the question. Brilliant. Okay, given we're probably getting towards the end of the time for the podcast, and it's been so interesting, I could keep asking you questions and hearing about other questions that you ask would be fantastic. But let's think about leaders right now and the challenges that they have. There are a number of great things, suggestions you've made about approaches for that. What would be the sort of one, two, three, four things that you think would really help leaders get out of the trap of too many things to do, too much solution focus, et cetera, and get themselves into more of the curly mindset?
So I think one really, really simple way of doing it is often we use language without really thinking about how it's influencing the way that we think and how it's influencing other people. And so one of the things that I always recommend is when you're asking a question as a leader of yourself or your team, often if you've heard it yourself say, how should we address this? How should we solve this problem? And if you just swapped should for could, how could we address this? What you're saying to your brain is, hang on a minute, there are many options, not one option. And I think even though it sounds really simple, if you recognize every time you say should, and then you swapped it with could, what you find is you start to get into a rhythm and get that, oh, yeah, okay, that's really interesting. And watch how it changes the conversation. So that would be
Yeah,
one.
wonderful.
The second one is, we often talk about telling people versus asking people and things like that. And it might be useful to think of, I think of telling as answering a question that either nobody has asked or nobody cares about. And so if you find yourself, there are times when you are answering a question, and that may that you are telling someone the answer because they have asked you the question. But sometimes we're telling people because we want to tell them. And so if you just recognize what question do I think I'm asking by giving this person this information, it can just maybe you keep going, but at least it's about awareness and asking yourself a question before you keep going with it. I think probably two more things. One is ask smaller questions.
Okay.
I, in a curly world, in a curly situation, it's more of a triple jump than a long jump. Right. So in order to get to the answer, you'll often need a couple of two or three questions, not one question. If you try and ask a big question, that's where you get stuck because you get stuck in the unknown and you don't know how to get out. And the last one I think is probably the most important one. One of the reasons that people don't ask questions is, I find, is that they don't know what to say, or they don't know how to formulate a question so it's right, etc. And I would recommend that instead of worrying about the words that are in the question, focus on your intention. Your intention is, are you wanting information, what is known, or do I want to build ownership? Do I want this person to feel inspired? Or do I want to change what we're doing and change the way we're thinking? And I think of that as going from you in the known zone, the own zone, to the, O zone. And just be clear about the intention.
I love that one. I, as
My
you know, I'm
fave.
very passionate about coaching, and helping leaders to increase their coaching capabilities. And if they do nothing else, asking open-ended questions
Yes.
is critical to that.
Absolutely.
And at times I see leaders really stumble around trying to ask an open question.
Yeah.
And often it's because they're kind of trying to make sure they get the answer they want. And I don't mean that in a rude, blunt sort of way, but
Yeah.
that is how it sounded.
Because
But
it's
there's a sense
right.
in which we can't, I mean, that idea of what is your intention? And being intentional about opening up a conversation to the other person, opening up, being inspiring for the other person. I think
Yes.
I'm going to use that. I'm going to steal that and use it. I love
Go
it.
for it.
Yes. All right, Kate, thank you so much. It's been a wonderful conversation. We could have many more on the same sorts of topic, but I think the focus that you have and what you've shared today is something that is not just interesting to us, but it's the kind of thing that we're trying to promote in our practices. It's the kind of the approaches, the mindsets that sit behind the work we're doing. You're about making life easier for people. Despite the enormous complexity, the disruptions, the uncertainty we face in the world, having some simple tools and things like this, simple but clever tools, actually helps to make the job of leading easier. So thank you so much for so openly sharing all of your ideas and your approaches and a bit about who you are. Thank you, Kate.
Thank you, Karen. Pleasure.